In 1944, I was traveling around the United States of America for the Committee for Economic Development. They were a local business committee. They had one of them here in Richmond. We had them all over the country, 2,300 committees. We got businessmen to get together to organize to find out where they were before the war, where they were during the war, where they'd be employment-wise after the war. And I'd been up in Rome, New York, organizing the town. They drove me at midnight down to Utica, where I was to catch a train for Boston. I had a meeting there the next morning. I'm tired. And in my hot little hand, I've got the most wonderful thing in the world in those days because people were sitting on suitcases in the aisles and trains. I had a Pullman stub that entitled me to a single bedroom. The train's an hour and a half late. And when I get on, I dig up the little Pullman conductor. Must have been 85 years old. They probably brought him out of retirement. He didn't go 5 feet with his antlers on. And I gave him the thing, and he looked at it and busted out laughing. I'd looked at that thing 8 or 10 times while I was walking around the station, Utica. I didn't see any jokes printed on it. I'm tired. What a time for levity. But I'm a what creator? I'm a pro. And I didn't get indignant. I didn't throw my weight around. I did what any good want creator would normally, naturally, instinctively do. I said to him, I haven't had a good laugh all day. Tell me, what's so funny? Well, he said, there's a guy got on in Buffalo that thought he had that bedroom, too. And he said, oddly enough, he said, there's been a guy sound asleep in there since Toronto, where the car started. Very funny. Very funny. Then I really knew I was a pro as I look back on it now, because instead of blowing my stack, I bought it. The government priority that got it for me and said I was entitled to it. I didn't start to throw my weight around. I knew that little guy was the only guy in the world that could get me horizontal between Utica and Boston. And I had to sell him. And so I found myself instinctively using the oldest, original, fundamental, simplest sales approach. We all know it. I said, tell me, I don't know much about railroading. You've obviously been in it a long time. You're an expert. How could a thing like that happen? Remember how you get them talking. Get them, you know that one? Simple, isn't it? Brother, that's all that little man needed. He took a deep breath. He threw back his head and he took off jet-propelled into space. And for 5 minutes, he explained to me what was wrong. And what do you think it was? Women. Women in railroading. Had no place in it. And he went on. He finally runs out of breath. Now, I don't agree with a thing the guy said, but I'm a pro, I'm a want creator. I don't believe a thing he said. Well, I've never had any trouble with women. But I'm no boob, I'm a want creator. So I said, well, sounds very logical, very plausible. Could be. I mean, you know more about that than I do, but tell me now, I'm tired. Could you do something about getting me someplace to sleep? So he shuffles those cards. You know how they do it? He said, how'd you like a drawing room? I said, drawing room? Gee, fine. How much extra? He said, extra? Why should you pay anything extra? He said, you bought a single bedroom, didn't you? You're entitled to it, aren't you? You didn't get it, did you? He said, boy, bring that man's bags. Come on through here. We'll go through the other side. Here, see? Jesus. And there's a beautiful drawing room all waiting for me at no extra charge. I thanked him. And then because I was curious, I said to him, how does it happen that with travel conditions the way they are, I'm this lucky? What'd you do for the guy that got on in Buffalo that was out of luck, too? He said, I gave him an upper. I said, he got on in Buffalo and got an upper? I get on in Utica and get a drawing room? He said, yeah, he got mad. He got mad. He was no want creator. He was not a pro. How do you behave when you're not selling? That's the test of being a pro. The professional want creator uses common sense. Now, that sounds very simple, doesn't it? But I'm going to talk to you now for about 5 minutes because I hope to make you so self-conscious that as you go about your job tomorrow and the day after that, you're going to remember some of these nonsensical things that good salespeople do because they're not pros. It's just common sense that everything we do is selling. But the average salesman doesn't understand that. He doesn't understand. This is unfortunate. That everything is selling. He doesn't understand that when a department store sends their delivery people out with clean, well-pressed uniforms, they're selling. That's the reason why a lot of salesmen aren't careful about their appearance.
The spots on their suit, the lack of press in the pants, or the frayed cuffs, or the dirty linen. A lot of them don't understand. The telephone company, the greatest monopoly of all time, and one that's under least fire from the government or the public, spent millions of dollars doing what? Why, trying to put a smile in the voice of the operator that you and I never see. Because that's selling. And why? Why, because they've so changed the conduct of those unseen voices that today you can get a wrong number, you have to wait for a long-distance call, you can blow your stack, you can curse them out. You can't pick a fight with those dames anymore. No back talk. That's right, isn't it? Remember the change? They spent millions of dollars. Why? Because that's selling. They know that's selling. A purchasing agent, if he's any good as a salesman, the good ones are bound to be salesmen. A purchasing agent, that a good one, doesn't sit there like a great stone face saying, no, 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 to the salesman. What does he do? Why, he says to the salesman, look, Joe, why don't you go back to the factory and see if they can't make that out of plastic instead of metal? Because if you could engineer 3 pounds of weight out of that, we could probably use that. Or why don't you make that with the corners round instead of square? Or why don't you countersink it so the screws' heads don't show? Or why don't you make it cheaper so... What's he doing? Why, he's selling the salesman the idea of going back to his factory to get something that he can buy effectively, efficiently, and economically for his employer. Everything is selling. But we've got to use common sense about it, and we don't. You and I know that there's one person that signs the order. But you and I know there's usually somebody else, one, two, three people, that are helpful. I spend a lot of time in reception rooms. I watch a lot of salesmen handle the young lady who comes to the fence or sits behind the desk or the telephone. And I watch these salesmen. And they don't use common sense. Some of them forget to take their hat off when they speak to that young lady. Oh, yes, I know she doesn't make much money. Yes, I know the company have placed her there for the convenience and service of the salesman. But it makes a lot of difference whether that girl picks up the phone and said, Mr. Motley is here for his appointment, or whether she says, there's a Mr. Motley here who says he has an appointment with you. Let me illustrate my point by a true story. In 1941, I was traveling across the country to speak to a meeting just like this in San Francisco. As I told you earlier, I've been doing this for years, and I'm going to do it as long as I'm physically and financially able to. I had a day in Chicago between the time the century arrived and the city of San Francisco left. And one of the bright young salesmen, the best I had in Chicago, said to me, if we go out to Swift and Company at the stockyards, I think we can sell them some advertising. We'd never had it. So I said, go ahead and fix up the date. He did for lunch. We went out. We talked to Vern Beatty and his associates. And at 4 o'clock, Vern said, you go down and talk to Mert Whelan of J. Waller Thompson, their advertising agency. Tell him what you told us, and I think we can do some business. And we grabbed a cab at the stockyards, beat it down to the Wrigley Building, and we got off on the 7th floor where the main reception room of this great advertising agency is. And as we stepped off the car, we met a dear little old lady, all dressed in black, since retired, Mrs. Davidson, leaving, pulling on her long black gloves. The office was closed. They had a staggered closing system. They had closed early on account of traffic congestion. And what did my smart salesman do? Use common sense? No. We'd just been out talking to the customer, the guy who spends $15 million a year in advertising. He told us to come down there. And so we began to throw our weight around. We began to impress this little girl, this elderly lady, with how important we were and how she had to take her gloves off and go back and find Whelan for us. Only she wasn't impressed. So I pushed this smart guy without good sense aside. And I began to pitch a little woo at the old girl. I learned a long time ago that any time a woman feels you need her, she'll do darn near anything she can to help you. And she finally took her gloves off and got that metal-pointed pencil and started dialing. It took her 10 minutes to find that guy in the maze of offices scattered over 5 floors. We never could have done it. We had an hour's meeting with him. I made my train for San Francisco. And when I was turning around to come back 2 days later, I got a wire from that salesman that said we had $104,000 worth of four-color Swift advertising. Who made that sale? Motley, the smart man from the head office? The smart salesman in Chicago? Or that little old lady in black that was there when we needed her and found the guy that we had to see to make the sale? Common sense, isn't it? I won't permit any salesman that works for me to smoke while he sells. If I catch him doing it, I'll fire him. They know that. And why? Well, I learned the hard way, the way most pros did. Years ago, I was invited by the head of one of the divisions of a great motor car corporation to sit in while the advertising agents made the presentation. A big fellow from New York, head of a big New York agency. I was vastly impressed. I'd never seen one of those things before. He must have had $25,000 worth of artwork and comprehensives and charts and market analysis studies and everything else. And when he got all through, my friend, the head of this division of the great motor car corporation, left the room first because he was the big wheel. And as he shook hands with this president of the New York agency on leaving, he said, "This wasn't very important to you, was it?" And the agent's face turned as white as my shirt. Of course it was important to him, $7 or $8 million involved. And then my friend gave me the tip-off. He said it wasn't as important as four cigarettes. Then I remembered. That man hadn't been going more than about 5 minutes before he started that old familiar search for that pack. He got the cigarettes, he tapped them, he lit it, he puffed. Somebody had to find him an ashtray. He broke the continuity. He lost his audience four times. And what for? Four lousy cigarettes. I don't smoke cigarettes. I smoke cigars. But I don't smoke them anymore when I sell. Because I began to wonder how many times I'd been selling a dirty, secondhand, chewed-up cigar butt as I pointed to the price list or some of the things on those signs or whatnot. What for? Not common sense. I fired a good man 3 years ago. I paid $750 for a statistical study, a market study, to permit him to sell an account. I went with him while he did it. We had a receptive audience. The prospect was willing. He cleaned off his whole desk, glass topped. And we stretched out all these figures, $750 worth. But this guy had to smoke a cigarette. He just couldn't stand it. And he lit a cigarette. And he laid it down on the edge. Glass covered, couldn't do any harm. But in the shifting of these long sheets of paper statistical material, the cigarette got knocked on the floor, and before it hit the rug, hardly, the prospect is up and around the desk and picks it up. What was he looking at? $750 worth of figures or that stinking cigarette that my salesman had left burning on the edge of his desk? Oh, yes, I know. I have ashtrays on my desk. I have salesmen come to see me, and they say, "May I smoke?" very politely. And I always say, "Of course." And then under my breath, "You damn fool." And why? Because I find myself looking at this chump, dragging that stuff down into his navel, and then for 5 minutes as he talks, it comes out of his eyes, ears, nose, and everything else. And I'm fascinated by it. What for? What for? What'd you go there to do? Put in an imitation of a smokestack on wheels? You went there to sell him something, didn't you? Not blow smoke in his face. It's just common sense that you ought to know how you look to the prospect. But I'll give you 6-2 and even. But 90% of the people in this room have no idea how they look to the man across the desk. They've never taken the trouble to find out. I didn't either. Until one night when I was taking a refresher course in the Book Cadillac Bar with another salesman. And he said to me, "Motley, you went to college, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You got a Phi Beta Kappa kid, didn't you?" And I said, "Sure, why?" "Well," he said, "I don't understand why you insist on making people believe that you're a tough guy, that you have no education." I said, "What do you mean?" "Well," he said, "you talk out of the corner of your mouth." I said, "I do not." He said, "You do too." The argument went on far into the night. It was a draw. I woke up the next morning hungover white like a weeping willow, but not so hungover that I didn't remember that crack. I didn't believe it. I went out to see a friend of mine, the advertising manager of the Chrysler Corporation, R.M. Rowland, now assistant sales manager of DeSoto in Detroit. And I said, "Rowley, you're a friend of mine. Tell me the truth. Do I talk out of the corner of my mouth?" And he said, "You certainly do, and I've often wondered why." Well, Mrs. Motley and the kids were in hysterics for months while the old man practiced his pitch in front of a mirror. But I don't talk out of the corner of my mouth anymore. Found out another thing, too. If I could keep on the rails with that funny-looking puss staring back at me out of the mirror, not even the stoniest face buyer could throw me off the track. I thought I discovered a new and wonderful fundamental principle of sales training. I told it to a sales manager, a friend of mine. He said, "Motley, that's old stuff. We have every year what we call the mirror contest. I've got 32 men on the road. I ask them for 6 weeks, twice a week, to practice their pitch before a mirror." And he said, "We always show an increase in sale, even the poorest salesman." How do you know how you look to the guy? I remember the last fascinating specimen that sat across from me. This is what he did all the time he was in there. This is what he did all the time. All the time. I found myself marveling at the durability of the human ear that could stand that sort of thing. That gouging, that digging in the ear with that forefinger. And then I found myself speculating as to what would happen if he ever succeeded in breaking through and getting inside that damn ear. The unfortunate, the tragic part about it was he didn't know he was doing it. He didn't have sense enough to go and find out how he looked to the guy on the other side of the desk. I instruct my salesmen not to take their hat and coat in the office when they make a call. I've had a lot of fellas say to me, "Well, there isn't any place to put it." And I have said to them, "Throw it on the floor and put the dry cleaning on the expense account." They say, "Well, a lot of times you leave it out there, it might be stolen." I said, "All right, take out an insurance policy and put that on the expense account, too." Why? You spend a lot of time getting the body in front of a prospect, and then what do? Why, you lug your hat and coat in to advertise to the guy that you're a bird of passage. "You don't have to pay very much attention to me. I'm not going to stay very long, mister." You spend a lot of time trying to meet him on an equal footing, don't you? And there's that picture of that dynamic, alert salesman sitting across from you with an overcoat, a briefcase, and a hat piled up on his lap, stripped for action. Oh, yeah, sure. Doesn't make sense. How'd I find that out? Years ago, traveling Indiana with a salesman of mine, and a good one, too. We were calling on the Stokely Van Camp Company in Indianapolis. Warren Tingdale was then sales manager. When we walked in the floor below, the telephone operator was at the telephone booth. She said, "Tingdale's expecting you. Go right upstairs." We did. As we walked in the outer office, two girls are pounding keys. There's no chairs, no hat racks, nothing but the tops of some filing cabinets behind, and I know they're covered that thick with dust. But I got rid of my hat and coat. But this chump I'm with didn't. He lugs him in wearing the coat. 5 minutes after I started talking to Tingdale, Tingdale turns to this guy and said, "Look, it's warm in here and cold outside. Don't you take your coat off?" The guy said, No, I'm all right. I'm all right. I'm fine." Three more times while we're in there, Tingdale stops everything and worries about this slob wearing an overcoat in a hat office. What for? Doesn't make sense, does it? Of course not. I don't care how long or how successfully you've been in business. Neither you nor I are smart enough to remember all we know. Last January, as I attended a few of Jack Lacey's lectures in San Francisco, I found myself sitting next to a man 78 years old who came every year and loved it and went away refreshed and inspired. He never heard a thing new. And I've told you nothing that you didn't know here tonight, really nothing. But it was important that it be told. Why? Because we're not smart enough to remember all we know. Maybe you think you are, but listen to my concluding story, and then maybe you'll agree you're not. In 1940, after a successful tour of the branches, I was taken back to New York by the great corporation I worked for. They made me a vice president and a director of the company. They gave me a private office with a rug on the floor, not linoleum. They gave me two secretaries instead of one. The office didn't have one window, it had two windows, so if things were bad, I had a choice of jumping. They even let me okay my own expense account. Now, you can't get any bigger in business than that. And what did I do? Why, a characteristically human thing. I decided to show these yokels in New York how we did it out in Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis, Cleveland, and whatnot. I rolled up my sleeves, picked up three or four tough accounts. One of them was the American Tobacco Company. At that time, there was a man by the name of George Washington Hill. He was the president of the company, chairman of the board, tobacco sales buyer, sales manager, advertising manager, janitor. He was the American Tobacco Company. If you didn't sell him, you didn't sell the American Tobacco Company. Now, I've told salesmen thousands of times, never let the guy get your goat, no matter what he does. Don't show any irritation. Don't flip your wig. Be cool. What did I do? I wasn't smart enough to remember what I knew. He unfolded his arms long enough to pick up a box, leather-covered, shaped like a carton of cigarettes, opened it up, there was some cigarettes in it, and he shoved it out at me. He didn't say, light up a lucky, have a cigarette. He wasn't polite, he was rude. And I said, no thanks. And he said, why not? And in a rather loud tone of voice, I said, I don't smoke cigarettes. And in a louder tone of voice, he said, why not? And in a still louder tone of voice, I said, I don't like cigarettes. Now, I've told salesmen thousands of times, never yell at a prospect or a customer. It just doesn't make any sense. I've read those books about how to win friends and influence people. I wasn't smart enough to remember what I knew. And then he said, don't you smoke anything? I said, yeah, I smoke cigars. He said, what kind? Oh, yeah. I've told salesmen thousands of times, never call on a prospect till you know his brand names, what he makes, his hobbies, the names of his kids. I spent 30 days getting an appointment with this guy, and I don't even know what kind of cigars he makes. So I told him the truth. I said, I smoke Anthony and Cleopatra's, and I suppose you're going to tell me they're no good. He said, not at all. We make those. He rang a bell, and a young man walked in with a box, and we bit off the ends and lit up and became friends, and Motley was saved by the bell, but not because he was smart enough to remember what he knew. This is a great profession, fundamentally important to everyone in America. It deserves a professional attitude from all of us. It deserves the kind of self-analysis I've tried to stimulate in your mind. It deserves the inspiration and the courage and the drive that Lacey talked to you about. And it deserves, above everything else, the true professional attitude. And that is the constant knowledge that no matter how good you are, you still aren't good enough. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Red. Thank you, Jack. We shall long remember the inspiration you've given us this evening, both of you, in this refresher course of one evening.